hopefully that's recording. We'll see what happens here. The thing that I'm going to probably refer to some stuff in the notes. I noticed that not very many people have this right here. Is this kind of a revelation to many people to see this right here? Did you know this was in the bookstore and all the lecture notes are right here and that sort of thing? So there may be things that I'm going to refer to in here and ask you to read about that on your own. So what you might need to do, if it looks like there are huge gaps here, take a look at somebody else who has that and you'll know what. But there are things in here that are not in the, they're not on some of the slides that I'm going to be talking about. Okay, endocrine pathology obviously is a pathology of signaling. Let's see if we could turn on some of these. Obviously, the original kind of way in which cells talk to each other when we have multicellular organisms evolving some years ago. And I mean, part of the system here is once you have multicellular organisms, you have a couple of problems to deal with. One is coordinated growth. When you have particularly specialization, such as a GI tract is going to be eating and digesting something and bringing it on board, what you really don't want to do is pee out all the nutrients that you just got or lose them all. It'd be nice to store them if you can. When you think about coordinated growth, on the other hand, it'd be kind of a bummer if your eyeball grew at one rate and the orbit that it sits in grew at a different rate. Either it's going to get squashed or it's going to fall out of there or something. And so you have to have some degree of coordination of all the actions here. In terms of salvaging what you're eating and so forth, you know, we have something like a glucose or insulin that's saying, hey, we just ate our neighbor, we're going to have a whole bunch of carbohydrates and amino acids, and both are triggers, by the way, for insulin release. There are two principal amino acids that will cause release of glucose or release of insulin from the beta cell, completely independent of what the glucose level is. At any rate, the idea would be then let's make it a point to store all this stuff so we don't lose all the stuff that we're digesting in the GI tract. So there are a lot of things, and then of course coordination in terms of reproduction and whatnot. So this right here are the original signaling system. All the surface receptors, such as these big protein hormones like growth hormone, TSH, ACTH, insulin. In fact, when you take a look at TSH, ACTH, and growth hormone, they're all the same hormone. There's very little difference between them. It's as if there is some sort of root hormone that they all came from, and then as specialization went forward evolutionarily, there was some modification of that probably primitive hormone, the growth hormone, to become TSH, which, by the way, is a form of growth hormone in its own right. It causes proliferation and growth in the thyroid gland. Not only does it cause release of T4 and so forth. More sophistication would be cytoplasmic receptors, internalization of steroid-like hormones, many of which are basically glorified cholesterols. If we take a look at cortisol itself, estrogen, progesterone, a variety of these things, testosterone, they're just glorified cholesterol is all they are. So there's some sort of manipulation there, and of course those are involved with direct transcription and translation and expression of genes and so forth, as opposed to modification of existing enzyme pool. Now, so it's kind of an interesting system, and one of the things that we'll see as we go with this now, and I'm sure you have some appreciation for that, is basically the pathology fits into just a couple of categories. Either you get too much hormonal activity, too little hormonal activity, or space-occupying lesion. And a space-occupying lesion may or may not be hormone reactive. Often they are not, by the way. When you see them, say, in the thyroid or pituitary gland, they don't make anything. They just simply are space-occupying, which means that in time, they may squash the rest of the gland. And so there's gland failure. So we'll take a look at that. When we see too little hormone production, probably what is the reason for it? Autoimmune destruction of the gland, which is extremely common, sort of inflammatory destruction other than autoimmune, and so forth. too much hormonal activity can't be the fact that you're taking it exogenously. You can get T4 easily online, thyroid hormone, people take it on their own, trying to lose weight, become extremely active and so forth, and may not recognize all the symptoms that come with taking too much hormone. And we do this to people by giving them glucocorticoids to change the immune system response to things, and we can make people dependent on those, in fact, at least temporarily. Now, one of the things that we don't really think about, is, and it's very difficult to sort of get the mindset of this, and that is the degree of interconnection of all the hormone systems. If we were to take a look at the cat's cradle, alrighty, I might have used this analogy before, but a cat's cradle, where you've got a loop of string and you make some kind of three-dimensional structure with it in your fingers, you know what I mean? You know, when I was a kid, we actually didn't have television. When I was really young, we had a radio. It's kind of hip listening to the radio. And we'd sit around listening to the radio, wishing that around the beginning of television. You know, I'm tired of the radio crap. Let's get into television stuff. Before there was radio, people would sit around with a loop of string, and they'd do this kind of thing all night long, saying to themselves, God, I wish you'd get around to inventing radio. This would really bore. Well, the point of this cat's cradle, though, is it's a three-dimensional structure. It's nice and tight. And right here is a hormone, right here is a hormone. They're all interconnected. One of them, one string gets very long. All the others are going to adapt to try and change and come to some kind of new, maybe stable, and yet abnormal situation where everything is no longer what we consider to be a normal release. Let's suppose that we had sort of flight or fright kind of thing. All of a sudden, there was a great release of epinephrine into the system. And the epinephrine string gets real long temporarily. Well, one of the things that's going to happen with that is it's going to be, among other things, of course, vascular constriction, blood pressure goes up, but also there's tremendous release of glucose. And, I don't want you to blow your, sneeze your nose off or something like that. It'd be kind of bad when you start today. But at any rate, so there'd be a tremendous release of glucose as part of that, so you've got a lot of juice there for your muscles, let's say. Well, what's going to happen next, of course, is insulin is going to come to work for you because the glucose just went up. There's probably also some degree of release of glucocorticoids, which is also going to prolong the elevated glucose and so forth. And you can see that the whole thing is going to start to shift around. And when we see very high non-physiologic levels of some hormones, it's amazing how many things will change within that and almost will be pathological in terms of the levels of them. So we're going to talk about it, and we study it, and we think about it as that the thyroid is completely independent of everything else. It's not. It's obviously completely interlinked to this thing. Somehow that beta cell function is just, we just look at that in the sense of how are we doing with respect to diabetes or something, but it's intimately connected to everything else. So it really is. I think this is probably the best example of how to think about it in the cat's cradle system. Let's take a look here at pituitary pathology. Pituitary is obviously a central regulatory endocrine organ. In itself is. It receives chemical signals and it passes them on. Of course, the chemical signals, for the most part, come from the hypothalamus. We're going to look first at the anterior pituitary and then a few words about posterior pituitary. In that situation, in the posterior pituitary, there is not that elaborate connection between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. The anterior pituitary, the cells have floated in there. They've migrated in there. Those are neurocrest derivative cells. Is that right? You know what I mean by neurocrest derivative cells? They come from that little ridge when the thing closes up. They migrate around to various places, and they populate that. What we have then is an elaborate vascular system, which is actually very slow-flowing blood coming through a system of veins from the hypothalamus into the pituitary, the anterior pituitary. And that's going to carry these signals that will tell the pituitary cells, I'm the releasing factor, I'm instructing you to release the hormone that's going to activate thyroid or the adrenal cortex or ovary or whatever, or testes. And so it is a system essentially of amplification. What we have here is, probably because we got so large in a way, is we needed a system of stepping up the control, expanding or making the signal louder. And the way we do that is that the releasing factor from the hypothalamus doesn't just release one ACTH or TSH molecule, it causes the release of thousands, hundreds of thousands, And so we're expanding, we're making the signal louder, so that downstream it will have even a louder effect yet. And it may simply be something that's basically just on the basis of our physical size and how we're going to go about that. One of the issues that we will see is in case of pituitary, anterior pituitary, is that that vascular plexus, slow flow, slow moving venous blood, is at risk for thrombosis. And one of the issues that will come up is when we see pituitary failure, particularly that involves all aspects of pituitary, it often is a vascular related issue in which that venous plexus has become clotted off, and then the pituitary, anterior pituitary, dies. Well, it's the same story, too much, too little, and space occupying lesions. Now here, space occupying lesions can be a real major pain in the butt, like pain someplace else. This is the basic structure. We're going to be looking at this guy here, the anterior pituitary again. First off, the hollow ball that is going to become populated by these neurocrest nerve cells migrates from our oropharynx up to the base of the skull and sits in the skull tercetum. This right here, posterior pituitary, of course, represent axons from supraventricular and supraoptic, rather, paraventricular nuclei. And there's not a lot of action that goes on here in terms of numbers like there is here. And it's not that kind of secondary system of amplification we have where hypothalamic signals are then going to be causing release of hormones downstream. This is the vascular structure I was talking about. So signaling proteins come from the hypothalamus, and their job is to induce cells in here to release TSH, FSH, LH, ACTH, and so on. Zoom height to you too. Okay, this is some of the control that's going on. And again, as our systems, multicellular organisms became more complex, reproduction became more interesting. Again, control of regulation of growth, coordination of growth, and so forth began. This system essentially evolved and came into being. Well, this is one of the places where we can understand what's going to go on, which will have rather obvious effects on vision, among other things, and that will be a tumor, space-occupying lesion in the cella tercetum. Here we're looking at that. These tumors that occur here are, for the most part, inactive. If they produce anything at all, it's prolactin. Most of them don't produce anything. Yeah, it is possible that you can have a growth hormone-producing tumor and have someone who's really big or develops with other conditions related to that, diabetes among them. Basically, space-occupying lesion. Here's a solid growth of a tumor that comes about later in life, but it doesn't have to be that. It is entirely possible that you can have a little cyst, a little cystic remnant of that Rathke's pouch that migrated up there to produce the pituitary, at least the shell of the pituitary. And if that little thing begins to accumulate shed epithelial cells, and it's perfectly benign, but there it is sitting in the cella tercetum, or part of the cella tercetum, and over time, as it gets larger, it squeezes the rest of the gland to death. In this particular case, most of the gland is gone. So we have issues with vision, but we also have downstream failure of everything. The person may be hypothyroid, they may have Addison's disease, may have evidence of failure of that, and so on. They'll stop menstruating, the woman, and so on. Anyhow, that would be downstream failure of everything thanks to that pituitary adenoma that's just squeezing the crap out of the gland. So here would be what we would see with this, bilateral hemianopsia involving the temporal visual field, which would correspond to the decubitus fibers, of course, here of the nasal retina. And as it impinges on the optic chiasm, that's what we would see there. And that's a for real symptom. And actually, sometimes as that's growing, if it hasn't actually done a lot of damage yet, so that you have downstream failure or very slow beginning failure downstream, the visual field changes may be the first thing. And what will happen is they'll be involved in a car accident because they have no lateral vision. And it occurs so slowly over time, people won't be aware of it. And they'll pull out in front of the car because there's no sense of anything coming from the side. So that's often a giveaway. Okay. The pituitary adenomas, as I mentioned, can make about anything, but for the most part, they don't make nothing. And for this space occupying, they are rare, to be honest with you. They get a lot of press, but in truth, they are rare. When we're taking a look at pituitary pathology, by far the most common reason for gland failure is a vascular event that clotted off that vascular plexus there. So I think you got an idea what's going on there. Let's just take a look here at something which we do have excess production of growth hormone, and that would be acromegaly. Now, if this occurs, if you have excess production of growth hormone and you're young and you don't have closure of epiphyseal growth lines, you'll be very large, right? You'll be tall. But the epiphyses are still active and you can grow. This person, it happens when they're 35 or 40 or 50, they're not going to increase in height because epiphyses are closed off. They will make new bone, they'll make a lot of bone, but it's appositional bone. It is layered on top. And you'll see very large fingers, prognathic jaw that's very jutting out jaw and so forth. And this person, I guarantee you, will have diabetes because the growth hormone is going to cause an increase in the sugar, the glucose. It's also going to cause an increase in size in the liver. On the other hand, it occurs when you're young, you're going to grow tall and you'll be 8 feet tall, something like that. You'll have diabetes, you'll be extremely uncoordinated, and you won't be able to see for crap. And if that occurred, let's say 3,000 years ago, and you were a giant living in the Middle East, you know, somewhere in the area of Judea or someplace, and your handlers brought you out to do battle with some little squirt of a shepherd. You know where I'm going with this? Mm-hmm. And the shepherd who has watched this giant understands that he has no lateral vision, and all he has to do is keep out of his way to the side, and he'll have no idea where the hell he is. And he's got a rock, he's got a missile, he can fire from 50 yards away, and boink, in the head, and the giant's gone. Okay? I think it's a classic, and if you read that sort of story, you'll find out that poor old Goliath did have a handler because his vision was so crappy that someone had to lead him around, in fact. It sounds very much like that's what he had. So it's a great example and story of that, probably very likely true. All right, at any rate, that would be prior to closure of the epiphyseal growth plates and so forth. Here we're taking a look at what happens. We refer to this as acromegaly, which just means everything's getting big on your extremities, but it's also going on inside the person. And as I say, they're all going to be diabetic. The new bone growth can also lead to closure of the openings in the skull, the compression of nerves that are exiting the skull, and so forth. Now let's take a look here at hypopituitarism, and this would be an example of the cyst I mentioned. Now clearly a tumor will squeeze the gland to death, and here's something else that's squeezing it to death, and this right here is a craniopharyngioma. This is a little cystic remnant of that Rathke's pouch that migrated from the oropharynx up into the solitursica developmentally, and if it starts to accumulate fluid, which it's going to do, it may take it a while, but eventually it will also squeeze the gland to death. This is perfectly benign, as is the pituitary adenoma, but it's in a really crummy location in terms of what are we going to do with it. You know, take the brain out, remove it, put the brain back. You know, they actually do that with heart surgery, by the way. When you have a really complex issue with trying to repair a valve or something, they'll actually put the person on heart one machine, take the heart out, and work with it outside, and put the heart back. Or you can do that there, but you can't exactly do that with the brain. Actually, this is not as complex a surgery as you might think. In fact, it's actually fairly simple, because you come up through the nose, right, square right into the solitursica, we can remove that side. All right, well, at any rate, this would be an example of a failure due to a benign cyst, but as the cyst increases in its size simply because of the accumulation of shed epithelial material, we end up with squeezing the gland to death. Also, depending on the kind of keratotic material or the stuff that's in here and its pH, it may accumulate calcium, and sometimes it'll look like there's a little snowstorm going on in there. Well, that would be an example of pituitary failure, overall generalized pituitary failure on the basis of a space-occupying lesion. This is the more common event, and it can occur in the postpartum period or during delivery. It can also occur because of vascular abnormalities or even overwhelming infections in the blood, and that would be loss of the vascular plexus. Here's an example. It's called Sheehan syndrome. Sheehan syndrome gets its name from a very specific event that takes place during delivery, and you can see there's excess blood loss here, let's say. Mom may have a period of hypotension. Because she was pregnant, she's also hypercoagulable, which is part of the deal with being pregnant. And what we're looking at here is an infarction because of thrombosis, that vascular plexus. It doesn't necessarily mean that all the gland is going to die. Maybe a part of it dies, and it may not be that there's enough reserve there that life will go on. And maybe at the next pregnancy, she loses a little more gland. Sometimes it's catastrophic with the first one, sometimes later, most times never. But at any rate, the event that's taking place here is it's an occlusion. It's a vascular injury of that little bitty, that tiny plexus of veins that brings the releasing factors down. So some of the things that we're going to see in this scenario then will be kind of uniform downstream failure of a lot of things. Hypothyroid, she will not start lactating. Adrenal failure, there will not be ovulation, so there will be no menses again. At any rate, a lot of stuff is going to go on. Well, it's the same sort of thing when if you have a tumor that's compressing it. In this case, it's just sort of catastrophic sudden event. You want to understand how that happens, please, okay? What the difference there, why that vascular plexus system is at risk, because it's a slow-flowing blood system. Posterior pituitary, generally speaking, requires a head injury, a closed head injury of some kind. Rarely tumors in that area, paraventricular area, can destroy the nuclei. Remember the ADH, oxytocin and ADH and so forth is being produced and basically pipe down those axons and released in the posterior pituitary. Closed head injury where someone gets actually impact right here. Remember we talked about coup and contra coup? Right? In this case, head injury, which the impact is here, a lot of the damage is on the opposite side. Contra coup gets the biggest injury, and that would be on the region of the hypothalamus and paraventricular nuclei, supraoptic nuclei. So this is where we see with bicycle injuries where people go off onto their heads, like the gal did a couple of days ago. I'm pretty excited to hear about that. The gal who was working out for a little fight, still in the hospital in critical condition. Motorcycle injuries, car injuries, and so forth, where it's typically some kind of impact right here. You want to understand what part is being injured. Thyroid, again, thyroid control. Why do we have this elaborate control? Well, in my mind, it's a system of amplification. You know the whole story here. Hypothalamus is really signaling it. It's looking at the T4 levels. Oddly enough, T4, of course, is not actually the active part of thyroid, is it? What is active? Out in your peripheral, what helps to set your body temperature and the overall metabolic rate? It's T3, not T4. T4 gets absorbed onto the surface of all the cells. One of the ions gets cleaved off. The T3 is internalized, and that's actually the active agent. All right, so we got a releasing factor causing TSH to be released, and then you have the excess stimulation here. Well, in fact, most of the time, this is theoretically what happens, but that's not what occurs in practice. We'll talk about what occurs in fact here in just a few minutes, but generally speaking, it's the thyroid gland being stimulated, oddly enough, by an antibody that mimics, that has a receptor that mimics the TSH. But this can happen. You can have a problem at the hypothalamic level, a problem at the pituitary level, you could have a tumor producing TSH. But most times the thyroid begins to function excessively when we see hyperthyroidism on the basis of stimulation from an antibody that binds to the receptor. Hyperthyroidism is a clinical syndrome, it's not a diagnosis. It's a syndrome, a whole collection of things. Rapid pulse rate, resting pulse rate is high. You want to turn the temperature down, you've got the AC turned way up all the time. Tremor, tachycardia, as I mentioned, they're hyperactive, lose weight. And most of the times it is antibody stimulating the TSH receptor on the thyroid cells themselves. Now the ocular changes here are not seen in all cases of hyperthyroidism. You can see your eyes bulging out up there. That's only seen in situations where there is excessive TSH stimulation or light TSH stimulation. You see, if somebody were taking thyroid exogenously, if they went out and bought it somehow and started taking it themselves and they showed up in the emergency room with all these symptoms here, they would have everything except her eyes. Because that change in the extraocular muscles and so forth is not a function of T4, it is a function of the TSH stimulation. In this case, we're looking at somebody most likely who has Graves' disease, that's the most common form of this. It's an antibody that binds to the TSH receptors and it makes the thyroid go crazy. Well, as it turns out, that antibody is not quite as clean as you might think, and TSH is basically a growth hormone. It's a modification of growth hormone. And in fact, TSH makes your thyroid gland grow. That's one of the reasons it doesn't really respond. I don't know if it responds at all to regular growth hormone. As you're getting bigger and you need a bigger thyroid, as you grow, you know, from a little shaver like this to a big shaver like this, you've got to increase the size and amount of your thyroid. And it's the TSH that causes it to increase in size. In this case, those TSH-like receptors or growth hormone receptors are in a lot of places. Subcutaneous tissues that we see here, and particularly on the surface of the muscles of the extraocular muscles. And when that antibody binds to those, it causes increase in actually ground substance material. And so the cells, the tissue gets bigger and plumper and the eyeballs kind of come out, but it's not a function of the thyroid, either T3 or T4, it's a function of that antibody binding to what would look like to get TSH receptors. And what it really is kind of a growth hormone receptor here, but obviously a TSH receptor. And that's what drives that. So most of the times when we see someone with it, they do have bulgy eyes, they do have that whole picture, because it is that antibody that's fooling or binding to the TSH receptor, as well as kind of like growth hormone receptors elsewhere in the body. The main effect then is going to be, yes, lots and lots of T4 is being released, and so they've got cardiac arrhythmias, they're jittery, they want to turn the temperature down, hyperactive, they lose weight, and so on. Yeah, I've listed some other reasons here that you can have that. So-called toxic goiter, which is either a tumor or the actual thyroid itself just taking off all on its own. You know, could you have a TSH secreting adenoma from the pituitary? Yeah, sure you could. And it does happen. It's not very common, but it does happen. In that situation, you may not have much in the way of eye changes in this. It depends on how high that TSH level is. The antibody locks on to the TSH receptor and does not let go. And so there is this continuous, unremitting stimulation in Graves' disease. You want to understand the difference between Graves and other forms of hyperthyroidism. Understand the clinical picture of hyperthyroidism and that there are a lot of reasons to get there, including taking thyroid that some your neighbor gives you or the dog's thyroid. Amazingly enough, it happens. This is taking a look here at this, and of course there are a lot of problems with eyes like this. You can't close them. You get conjunctival drying, you can have corneal and conjunctival scarring, and infections and so forth. And finally, when this thing is recognized for what it is, that stuff is not going away. That almost certainly has to be surgically removed. That junk behind the eyes and so forth. And Lord only knows how you do that. So the hyperophthalmia is a function of the the TSH-like stimulation. Here's a classic example of a thyroid. I'm sure you've seen thyroid follicles. And what I'd like you to see here is a follicular cell. Here's the choroid in the middle, and you can see these bubbles like all around it. We refer to that as scalloping. That is a pathological finding. It means that those thyroid follicular cells are being driven absolutely nuts to release thyroid hormone. The stimulus, the TSH-like stimulus to them is profound. So that would be an example of histologic appearance of hyperthyroidism on the basis of either high TSH or an antibody that mimics it. Now, hypothyroidism can be genetic in nature, and that happens a lot where you don't have the genes to go ahead and manufacture T4, and that's a disaster when that happens. You have to recognize that very early and get the kid on T4 very early, or there'll be very minimal post-delivery, post-birth brain development. So genetics play a role, gland destruction, inflammatory surgical removal. My wife has no thyroid gland, it was surgically removed. So she's on T4 the rest of her life. Now, she gets a little flaky later, and she thinks, I've been taking these pills for 10 years, I ought to be cured of it, I'm going to stop taking my thyroid. Well, after 10 years, hell, I ought to be better. Well, a lot of people think that, older people do, and they'll stop taking their medication because I've been taking it long enough. Well, surgical removal is an issue. Radiation therapy, obviously you have to have iodine in order to make the T4, iodine deficiency is a rare event now. It was not a rare event prior, say, to World War II, even in this country. Now it's spiked into practically everything, but especially our salt, and we love eating salt. And so we end up getting our iodine daily requirement that way. Well, you can actually back it up, of course. We've already talked about problems at the pituitary level, hypothalamic level, so you can miss the stimulus. All of these things will lead to this other clinical syndrome of hypothyroidism. Now, before I go on and take a look at that, we're going to take a look at what happens when you have genetic deficiency. There are a variety of genes that gene product that are involved in enzymes that are involved in the production of T4. If you don't have that, you can't make T4, there's complete growth retardation. I'm sure that you have probably used the term referring to your brother or sister as a cretin. Am I right on that one? You ever refer, or somebody else, you don't stick with your wife, cretin? You ever use that term? You don't? Have you heard that term? Cretin, you know. You're just a really nice guy. You wouldn't call anybody cretin. Is that what you know? Well, cretin, by the way, is, as you might know, is a French word for Christian. And a cretin was so incredibly retarded, they were incapable of even thinking of a sinful act, much less carrying it out. And so a cretin is an original Christian. They are so mentally retarded, they cannot function, but they cannot sin. And so they are Christians. They are original Christians. That's a cretin. They are terribly retarded. Growth as well as mentally stunted. If we recognize that early on and we put the kid on T4 and they're going to be on it the rest of their lives, well, everything is fine. Development goes right on. And so, as you might know, in the state of Indiana, I think they're with the state union, we test newborns for T4 levels. And we find them all the time. And you need to get them on that thyroid almost immediately. Now, one of the things that seems to be a hassle is that this kid is developing in utero just fine. And we tell the parents you have to come back in about 3 days, or we'll send somebody out, we'll do it if you'd like. And we'll take the blood sample, do a little heel stick, we'll take a little blotter paper and put it on the blood, and that's all we need to do to test. But we can't do it. So we'll do it in the hospital and get it over with. I don't want to have to come back. I got two other kids at home I got to deal with, you know? Why can't we do it in the hospital when they're first born? Yeah, because all you're measuring is mom's T4. You got to wait a little bit for the T4 in the baby to drop because mom's no longer supplying it. That's where it came from in utero. She was making T4 for two. And so you got to wait for it to go down a little bit. Then you can say, oh, okay, now we got a problem here. And that doesn't happen immediately. So we can't do it on day one. We got to wait a couple of days, maybe 3 or 4 days to test that. And then you get the person on it and everything's going to be fine. Now, when this develops later in life, then we will see this collection of symptoms here. Cold intolerance, very slow heart rate, high serum lipids, or lethargic as hell. We have terrible photophobia. What does that mean, photophobia? What do you think that word means? If they're phobic about something, do they want to embrace it? Do they like it? Are they afraid of it? What do you think? They're afraid. If you're photophobic, they're afraid of light. Sounds silly, but I remember an older woman who was brought in by her daughters into the emergency room who had a towel wrapped around her head like a turban. She had it wrapped around so she would not see any light. And she described it as painful. The light caused pain in her eyes. Terrible photophobia. They developed all kinds of junk down here. In the skin, kind of like they get edema, but it's like having toothpaste in there. And that's very similar to what we saw, if you may recall. Look, there was something I talked about, increased cellular, extracellular fluid in here, and that happens because of the high TSH level. These symptoms here are almost always due to gland failure, and you have very high TSH, very non-physiologic high levels of TSH. It can't make the gland work because the gland has been destroyed almost always because of inflammatory stuff. So at any rate, this would be a clinical syndrome, a collection of findings, and the doctor would say, you have a diagnosis of hypothyroidism, but you've heard my lecture, so you would say, doctor, you are incorrect. You don't have a diagnosis of hypothyroidism. What do you have? You have a clinical syndrome. that meets this. There are, doctor, pay attention to me now, there are at least five or six reasons for this that I can tell you about right now because I paid attention to Dr. Bonifacio. Right? There could be an issue at the hypothalamic level, the pituitary level, there could have been autoimmune destruction here, and God knows what's that scar in her neck, and she doesn't even have a thyroid. And she's kind of forgotten about it because she's got Alzheimer's disease now, and she stopped taking her medicine. Mm-hmm. All right, so there are a number of causes. This is simply a clinical syndrome. And what the doc has to do is say, what are the causes for this? You will see people in your practice, I know, who have a history of this. It's the kind of thing you need to be tracking right along with everybody else, their health provider. So this will be the kind of picture that, irrespective of how the person comes about to have it, we'll take a look at the common causes for that in just a minute. We're going to take a look at inflammatory conditions, and that's typically what it is, autoimmune destruction. Let's take a look first here at some tumor changes, which may be a response to either low low iodine in the diet, which means you can't make the T4, or a variety of things. And sometimes the gland will just kind of grow on its own, but we'll have what we call a goiter. And this was extremely common prior to World War II. Lots of people had big old growths in their necks of their thyroid glands, even sometimes causing compression of the airway, certainly involving recurrent laryngeal nerves, so speech problems and so on. A lot of the people here on the voice faculty at IU have their thyroids insured such that if anything ever happens there and they lose that recurrent laryngeal nerve, they're going to pay out because then they can't perform. They can't do what they're supposed to do or would like to do. And thyroid will, because that nerve that goes back and innervates the larynx, innervates the vocal cords, has to loop back and through there. So this is just an example of a gland that's grown in size, often because of TSH stimulation or because it just decided to grow, I guess. Here we're taking a look at some examples of that. Maybe uniform enlargement, often a goiter, which is not a tumor per se. It's that the whole gland typically responds in some funky way so that you have nodular growth and areas of dropouts and scarring. And you can imagine if that's big enough, it's riding right there on the trachea, it could actually cause airway compression and nerve trap and so on. So these are some of the things that we would see in that. Here would be an example. This has been sliced in half and laid out like a boiled egg. So you got to imagine, you got to put it back together so you get to see, double section here. So if you take an egg and you slice it and you do that to it, you got yolk on both sides, right?
Yeah.
So what we're looking at here is a thyroid that's been cut and open. So here's the same tumor. You put it back together. Most thyroid adenomas, true adenomas, are in fact neoplasias. But they're benign. They don't metastasize. They don't invade the rest of the gland. And almost all of them are completely functional. They don't really do anything. On occasion, we do see one that takes off on its own and decides it wants to release tons and tons of thyroid hormone. But for the most part, they don't. And so it's got a capsule around it here. You'll see that right here. It's solitary. It's not invading anything. And we take look at that microscopically. They do look a little bit different than the other thyroid tissue, but they're not overtly malignant. There are not a lot of mitotic figures and so on. Malignancies of the gland are not uncommon, and they can occur at any age. And we've diagnosed them here in kids as young as teens, and it's not uncommon to diagnose it in people who are grad students and so forth, your age group, by the way. Most commonly, they are papillary, and I'll show you a picture while we call it that in a minute here. But one of the things that's nice about the more common varieties of this, the papillary or follicular, is that they know that they are thyroid cells. And they may metastasize, they like to go to lymph nodes and bone and lung and even the brain, but they are still thyroid cells. And so we can feed them, we can inject into the person after the surgery, after we remove the gland, we can inject into them radioactive iodine, and all those metastatic foci will suck up that radioactive iodine and it burns them away. So it's an interesting thing that it's one of those quite curable malignancies, with the exception of this anaplastic, which is highly aggressive. Very uncommon, blessedly, variety of it. We'll say a few words about interstitial cell tumors. You know, that's a different kind of hormone. The thyroid gland is actually two glands in one. It's the thyroid as well as calcitonin producing. All right, here's the more common variety of malignancy, and that is capillary carcinoma. Instead of growing in follicles, the glands grow, the malignant cells kind of grow in little bunches, and they call in to be connective tissue and a vascular structure to grow on, and so it looks like little branches of a shrubbery, you might say. And so that's their appearance. I've never known one to produce T4 and can make, say, a person hyperactive, hyperthyroid, and I've never known it get to the point where there's enough gland destruction that you wind up being hypothyroid. They're picked up because of the mass, space occupied. It's not uncommon for them to be multicentric like this. Radioactive iodine is a main trigger for this. Inflammation can also do it, and TSA, prolonged TSH stimulation. But radioactive iodine is probably the leading thing. And when we see people who've had exposure to dust, in particular from things like what occurred in Chernobyl some years ago, many years ago in Russia, and went on in Japan most recently, and back in the 1950s when we were busy setting up hydrogen bombs in the South Pacific, and the wind changed and we blew up the first atoll we blew up was Bikini Atoll, and it vaporized the entire island, and unfortunately the wind shifted and all of the radioactive dust blew over the Marshall Islands, and all the Marshall Islanders were exposed. They have the highest incidence of thyroid cancer in the world, and because they're radioactive iodine, they picked it up and the tumors developed. At any rate, this is what it looks like. Untreated, it's going to kill you. It likes to metastasize in a variety of places, as this image shows. However, they do remember that they are thyroid cells, and if we will inject thyroid radioactive iodine into the person, the metastasis will pick it up and they'll die. Here we're taking a look again, same thing. It's a boiled egg, it's been cut in half, so you're looking at yolk on both sides. We're looking at a cancer right here, and this is what the path lesions look like. When we see this in needle aspiration, that's typically what we'll do. I did a fair number of these. The doc will send it in. The doctor who's taking care of the patient will say, I've discovered this nodule in the thyroid. Can you put a needle in it, suck out some cells, take a look at the cells? And when we do that, we will see a very characteristic appearance, and why I don't know, this nuclear clearing. These are nuclei. We refer to them as orphan antinuclei. Harold Graham drew little orphan anti during Depression years, as you might know, and she had no pupils. She just had open eyes. And we refer to that nuclear change or anti nuclei. It gets boring in the lab sometimes. I mean, I don't have a lot of contact with people. I'm sort of hanging out there, me and the glass slide with the microscope. And so we start looking for things to entertain ourselves. That's where I don't know. Well, keeping in mind that the thyroid had other cells within it. We also have the interstitial cells. These are also neurocrest derivative cells. Of course, the bulk of the thyroid itself, of course, does not come from neurocrest. The bulk of the thyroid, the actual that produces T4, comes from the endoderm, comes from the GI epithelium. And it comes from the base of the tongue that migrates down there. But neurocrest derivative cells do migrate into the thing. And those are the calcitonin, the so-called interstitial cells, calcitonin-producing cells, C cells. And we occasionally will see cancers arising in that. This is one thing the pathologist and the practicing doc needs to be aware of, is that there's a high incidence of familiarity. I don't know if that's the right word. Many of these have a genetic, an inherited genetic basis. And almost a third of them will have some sort of somebody else in the family that have it. So when we see one of these things, the first thing you need to do is go back and say, hey, you got to kind of round up the family, have them all go see if they've all got this, and how many of those may have also have interstitial cell carcinoma. This is likewise will metastasize and kill the person. It produces lots of calcitonin. Of course, calcitonin is trying to push calcium down, but I don't know that it really ever we ever see people with low serum calcium. I've seen a handful of these, but I've never seen anybody with low serum calcium because of high serum calcitonin. All right. The other thing that these tumors produce is amyloid, beta-plated sheet protein, and we'll see that in the background, the cells themselves, and the cancer coming from interstitial cells. Of course, they don't, they're not in the follicle, they're in between the follicles, and they kind of grow as little cords and sheets in here, and that's what these are. And then they produce all this, what looks like collagen, but when we do the amyloid stain, we see that it's a beta-plated sheet protein. And truthfully, I don't know the nature of that beta-plated sheet, what it is. But this is showing with the special stain to demonstrate that, you know what, that's not collagen like you thought it might have been. This is a good place to stop. I know we're a little ahead. If you will come back, please, and by that clock, and I don't know what it means outside, come back in here at 10 o'clock, at 9 o'clock rather. We're going to try and make tracks and see if we get this whole thing done in the next hour. See you in about 10.